This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We'll probably need two further shiurim on it. The subject is the Egel Hazov, is the golden calf. And what we want to analyze here is a deeper understanding of what exactly the intention of the golden calf was, what exactly the Ribbono Shel Olam got so angry about, and why and how it happened. The strangest part of all of the Egel Hazov is not so much in the action and in the events of the golden calf as in the response of the Ribbono Shel Olam to the golden calf. Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe, and Hashem spoke to Moshe, Lech reid ki shiches amcho asher heilesu meretz Mitzrayim, go down because the people who you brought up from Mitzrayim have been destructive, degenerated. Soru mahir min haderech asher tzivisim, they have very quickly departed from the way I instructed them. Osu lohem egil masechol, they have made themselves a calf of artificial materials. Vayishtachavuloy, and they have bowed down to it. Vayizbechuloy, and they have sacrificed to it. Vayyemru, and they have said, Eile Elokecho Yisrael, these are your gods Yisrael, asher he'elucho meretz Mitzrayim, who brought you out from the land of Israel. It's the end of the first statement. So he says, go down and attend to them. I've seen what's happened. They've gone down, their whole standard has dropped. They're dancing around this golden calf. They're saying, you better go down quickly and see what's happened. And then a second statement again. A new thing Hashem says to Moshe. I've seen this people, who when they are a stiff-necked people. They ato, and now that they're a stiff-necked people, allow me to get angry with them, va'achalem, and I shall destroy them, v'e'eser, and I will make you into a big nation. About the golden calf, he tells Moshe, go down and attend to them, educate them, look after them. About their stiff-neckedness, he says, I must destroy them. And this is not commonly perceived when we talk about the Egel Hazov. You remember, going back to the shiur of 2 weeks ago, we discussed how important it is to be able to break away from one's childish concepts, particularly in matters of Chumash and Tanakh. One has to be able to do it in everything. One has to be able to break new ground and perceive things in an adult fashion. But particularly in a thing like the Egel Hazov, the story we learn as such young children, and in this country most of us were taught that story by such apikursim, that if we stick by those impressions, there's no way we'll ever understand it. And we discussed 2 weeks ago how difficult it is to break away from those impressions. And this is just one example of one of the key points in the whole story of the Egel Hazov, which people don't usually notice. It wasn't the dancing around the Egel that got God so angry. What got him so angry was the stiff neck, was the kashus oreh. For that I've got to destroy them. There's a general principle which Rav Nosson Hirschfinkel draws from that, which we'll just touch on. The general principle, he says, is if a person does an Aveiro, that doesn't justify his destruction. No matter what the Aveiro is, even if it's Avodah Zorah. Avodah Zorah is one of the three cardinal Aveiros for which one has to rather give one's life. One doesn't do the Aveiro. So serious is the Aveiro of Avodah Zorah. Nevertheless, to do an Aveiro, that doesn't justify destruction. A bad midah, a bad characteristic, that yes. An Aveiro, the Ribbono Shel Olam is prepared to wait. You'll do tshuva, you'll repent, you'll change. You did the Aveiro, you'll undo the Aveiro. Anything can happen. But when there's a flaw in the personality of the person, when there's a flaw in the character of the person, there's very little hope. There's very little that can be done. And it's on that the Ribbono Shel Olam says, I want to wipe them out. And we're going to have to understand it a little bit more deeply than that too. Let's take Rav Nosson Hirsch's concept one step further. He says that the most divine aspect of the human being is his koyach habechira, his ability to choose. That's which the human be. That is what the human being has, which no other Briya has. Not Briyas below him, and not Briyas above him. Animals don't have it, and angels don't have it. The ability to decide what to do. The ability to decide what to do, maybe others do have. Maybe animals have that too. You hold a nice juicy piece of meat in front of a dog, he'll decide to come and take it. That he can do. It's the ability to decide what not to do that only a human being has got. Try and hold the juicy meat in front of the dog and see if he'll decide not to come of his own free will. That not. That he isn't able to do. The doing of an Aveira, says Reb Nosse Hirsch, does not deny that essential part, that the essential divinity of the human being. What is the essential divinity? The ability to choose, the Bechira. And what is doing an Aveira? The exercising of that choice. So on the contrary, in doing an Aveira, you are in fact affirming your divinity. As bad as it is, and it needs to be repaired and everything else. But the act of doing an Aveira is not something which negates the very essence of what the human being is. No! The doing of the Aveira, in fact, is an expression. It's because you are so divine. It is because you have the Koach HaBechira. It is because you are uniquely human that you're able to do an Aveira. That's the Chiddush. And for that, God's not going to destroy you. Get angry, he'll hope that you'll do tshuva, he'll punish you, all sorts of things. But that isn't a justification for an annihilation of the individual. Because he has done nothing to annihilate the Tselem Elokim, to annihilate that image of the Ribbono Shel Olam in which he was created. The doing of an Avera, says Reb Nosse Hirsch, does not annihilate the Tselem Elokim. It's a little bit different to what we learned at the Shalosh Shuvos. But when there's something wrong with a midah, when there's something wrong with a characteristic, there yes. Particularly the characteristic of kashyus oiref, of stiff-neckedness. That does go against the very essential, the very essence of the human being. And that we will understand why this evening. What was the nature of that Aveda? So many, many things have been written on this, there are many perushim. One thing is clear from all the Meforshim, two things that we need to understand as an introduction before we even start analyzing the parasha. The one is that it was not all of Klal Yisrael who were involved in this. It was primarily the Erev Rav. It was primarily those non-Jewish people that joined the Am Yisrael out of Mitzrayim in the hope of becoming part of Am Yisrael on the way. They were primarily responsible certainly for the idea and for the selling of the idea to the others. And according to many Mefoshim, even in the practice of the idea, there weren't that many of the Jews themselves who were involved, and according to some Mefoshim, there were no Jews involved in the Egel Azor. Why does the Ribbono Shel Olam want to destroy them? Because they didn't stop it. The fact that they allowed it, the fact that they tolerated it, is also not in order. But that's what they did. We need to see it in its correct perspective. It's not that the Yidden who stood at the foot of Mount Sinai were themselves dancing around an Egel Azor the next day. It wasn't them. Yet, this is clearly something they did wrong. What did they do wrong? They tolerated it. The next thing that's important to understand is that it wasn't blatant idolatry in the normal sense of the word. We learnt on Friday night that according to the Ramban and according to the Ibn Ezra and according to Rashi, according to most Meforshim, they didn't want an image to replace God. They wanted an image to replace Moshe. They wanted something that would stand in front of them. It wasn't that they wanted another God. They accepted the Ribbono Shel Olam. It would have been absurd for them not to have accepted the Ribbono Shel Olam after everything that had happened. They knew about the Ribbono Shel Olam. They knew his power. They knew the magnitude of his koiches. They knew all that. They wanted something to stand before them, something to represent godliness, the way Moshe Rabbeinu had represented it to them. What we're going to base tonight's shiur on is a piece of the Kuzari. Now, I don't think I've ever done a Kuzari with you before in this shiur. The Kuzari is a very important sefer of Jewish philosophy. And it was authored by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in Arabic. It was translated by Rabbi Yehuda ibn Tibun into Hebrew. The Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was a Rishon. And it's based on a historic event, which was the search of the king of the Khuzars for the truth. He kept on having dreams, this king, that his beliefs were very good, but his actions were no good. And he couldn't understand them. Whatever he did, an angel came to him in a dream and kept on saying that your ideas are good, your thoughts are good, but the actions aren't right. And he couldn't understand that, because most philosophies and most religions, what's important is the ideas, and the actions aren't that important. And he decides to go on a search to find out what are the right actions, what is he doing wrong. And he interviews the leaders of the various different religions, including Talmidei Chachomim, and the Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi writes the Kuzari as a debate, as a discussion that took place, questions and answers, between this king of the Khuzars and the Chover, the Talmid Chachom, who discusses the matter with him. One of the most important chalokim of the Sefer is the Chelek Shlishi, is the third Maimer, which is the one that is most oft learnt. What we're going to do is a little piece from the first Maimer, paragraph Tzadi Zayin. After a bit of an introduction, which I'll do with you a little later, the Kuzari says the following: V'chatosom hoyoso, and their sin was, B'tziur asher ne'esar aleihem, in that they produced a tziur, a form, which was forbidden to them in the Ten Commandments. That's number one. They have no right, they are not entitled to create a form which is going to be worshipped. V'sheyichsu inyan eloiki, and that they attributed a godly aspect, El Masha Osu Beyodom, to something which they had made with their own hands, Uritsoinam, and their own will, Mibli Mitzvas Hoelukim, without the mitzvah of the Ribbono Shel Olam. So the Kuzari says two things. Number one, that they made a form, and forms were forbidden, you aren't permitted to worship a form. That's number one. But number two, he says, even if the form was a permitted type of form. Right, what's a permitted type of form? What would be okay? Let's say that. What is the Kuzari trying to say? The one thing he says, they made a form. Good, I understand that. They made an eagle. They shouldn't have. And then he says, v'sheyichsu another aveira they did, that they attributed godly aspects to something which they made themselves. So what wouldn't have been a form? If they'd made what? No. That they were allowed to make, right? For example, an Aron Kodesh, a Mizbeach, a Kiyur, all the things that they had in the Beis Hamikdash. There were many things that they had in the Mishkan which they were meant to make, which they were instructed to make. Had they made something like that? So the Kuzari says two things. Firstly, they made a tziur, they made a form. Where? Who found an eagle? Where do we find such a thing in the Torah? That's not part of the Beis Hamikdash. And what would be if they made Kruvim? What would be if they made those two angels with their Knafayim, Poshim, Lamala, and etc. as the Torah describes it? Would that have been an Aveda? Says the Kuzari, yes, that also would have been wrong, because Sheyichesu Inyan Eloiki El Masha Osu Beyodom. They attributed a godly element to that which they made with their own hands, Uretzoinom, and by their own will. So the Kuzari, that's the second thing that they did wrong. So now we have two things. That they made a golden calf, and that we won't deal with, because that everybody knows. The chiddush of the Kuzari is in the second. And even if it wasn't a golden calf, even if it was a mizbeach or a shulchan or a menorah, to attribute godly elements to something that they invented, that was the aveira. And says the Kuzari, don't be so shocked about the eagle, he says later on. Don't be so shocked that they made a calf. We're very shocked because it's so foreign to us. Make a calf, what exactly is it? But in their day, that was a perfectly normal and accepted form of avodah, of service, of religious practice. The Kuzri says there was a time in history where we weren't allowed to build shuls. Not that the governments didn't allow us, the Torah didn't allow us. There was one place, that was Yerushalayim. We weren't allowed to build private little places and individual places, all had to be in Yerushalayim. And would we have been so shocked if somebody would have built a shul there? We wouldn't, because we're used to that. So the Khuzri says, we only get shocked by the production of the Egel, because that's not in our day an accepted form of worship. It's so idolatrous, it sounds so pagan. But in their day it wasn't so pagan, it wasn't so foreign at all. It was certainly wrong. That doesn't reduce the wrongness. He's just saying it reduces the strangeness. It's not as strange as it sounds. It's as wrong as it sounds, but it's not as strange as it sounds. And let's get away from that, says the Khuzri. Let's imagine they would have made a Mizbeach. Let's imagine they would have made an Oren. Let's imagine they would have made a Shulchan. Then it wouldn't have been strange to us, because the Kli, the particular object they would have manufactured, would have been one which is familiar to us in our Avodas Hashem. So we wouldn't be so shocked. Says the Khuzri, but the Avera would be no less. Because what was the Avera? That they attributed godly elements to something that they made themselves. What was the Avera?
What's the Kashyus Oref? What is the stiff nakedness? Says the Sipurnu. Vehinei Am Keshei Oref Hu. And behold, this is a stiff necked people. Gid Barzel Orpom. Their neck is made from sinew of iron. What does he mean by that? Sinew of iron, their neck has no flexibility. They have inflexible necks. That's what koshi oref means. Stiff neck means iron neck. Veloy yifnu lishmoya divre shum moire. Moire tzedek. And they will not turn to listen to the words of any rov. Ba'ofen, in such a way. She'ein tikvo she'yoshuva b'tshuva.
There is no way that they can come to do tshuva. This Sipurnu is mind-blowing, particularly in the lines of our first introduction. So they made an egel, they made a form which they shouldn't have. So they attributed godly aspects and elements to it which they shouldn't have. For that, God says to Moshe, go down and get them straight. You better give them a shir and avodah zorah, and you better teach them what it's all about. Go and get them straight. Look what's happening. But when God says, I observe that they're kashi oref, there's no hope. Lo yifnu lishmaya divrei shum moire tzedek. They won't subject themselves, they won't turn themselves, they won't apply themselves to hear the words of a moire tzedek. And in that, says the Sipurnu, we see she'ein tikvo she'yoshuva b'tshuva. There is no hope that they will come to tshuva. We've been talking over several weeks now about the apparent conflict in Yiddishkeit of the necessity to subject oneself to a moire tzedek. The necessity to be mevatel oneself, to be mevatel one's das, to completely nullify one's thinking and one's opinions to a moire tzedek, and on the other hand, to be a responsible human being who's prepared to take responsibility for his actions, to be an original human being, to be a unique human being. This element of bitul das, of a peniel lishma divrei moire tzedek, or as Rashi puts it in a very similar way, machzirin kashi orpom leneged moichichehem. Rashi learns not that their necks are inflexible. The neck is a strange part of the body, because the neck expresses the degree of arrogance and the degree of bitul. That's what it is. That's what the neck expresses. I tested the shear out on my 2-year-old daughter. Her name is Bruria. And I said to her, you're not Bruria, you're Ashira. She said, no, look, I'm not. And she stuck out her neck. I said, why is she sticking out her neck? I said, you're not Bruria, you're Olivia. No, she said, she stuck out her neck. Try it on any child, it works. The individuality, the assertion of self, requires the throwing back of the head and the standing up of the neck. That's how one asserts one's own individuality and one's own uniqueness. It's the neck. A person who's subjecting himself, a person who feels humble in the presence of somebody greater than him, he bends his neck a little bit. He doesn't stand up quite as high. It's from the posture of the neck that one can tell the degree of the kashi oref or of the bitul das. Is this a person, a stiff-necked person, or is this a person with bitul, a person who is prepared to subject himself? The Sipun who takes it, but the neck is made from iron, it's inflexible, he's incapable of bending his neck. Rashi takes it slightly differently, but it's the same concept. Machzirim kishi orpom leneged moichichehim. When somebody is moichiach them, when somebody points out that they're doing wrong, they turn the back of their neck, the hard part of the neck, which is the back, they turn to the moichiach. Umema'anim lishmoya, and they refuse to listen. The same concept, the inability to listen to a Moire Tzedek, the inability to listen to somebody who says, but hang on a second, you're wrong. What you're doing is not right. And we see the Yesod in the Sipurna, that without that there is no Yiddishkeit. If one isn't able, if one's neck is made from iron, if one's not able to bend the neck, there's nothing. They stood at Har Sinai days before. Look what a level they were on. They were on a level that nobody has been before or since. They heard the Ribbono Shel Olam himself say, Ani Hashem Elokeichem, the whole story he heard them say. Word for word. They stood at moments of nevuah, at moments of prophecy. What they were able to perceive and the levels that they in fact reached at those moments are beyond our wildest imaginings, never mind our expectations. So great were they. And a few days later, the Ribbono Shel Olam is prepared to destroy them because they have no hope. They'll never get anywhere. How's that possible? We talked 3 weeks ago, three shiurim ago, about how what's important is not where we are. What's important is where we're going. That you can have a person who's just at the beginning, but he's moving up. And he's far more dynamic and has far more promise than the person who's way up at the top, but he's on his way down. And we talked about investment. If a person wants to invest money, he would rather invest money in a little business that's just in its beginnings, but it's moving up, rather than in a mammoth of a business which earns millions and millions in profits, but each year they're earning a little bit less and the thing is going down and down and down. It's not how big or how high. It is the thing. What is the potential of the thing? Is it growing or is it decaying? We identify with spring, not with autumn. We identify with growth and development, not with decay and degeneration. And so as great as these people were, they were on levels never before or since achieved by the human being. But they're on their way down. And the Ribbono Shel Olam sees at that point already that there is no hope. They can't get anywhere. There cannot be a future. This can't be the people that the Ribbono Shel Olam is going to build. Why? One thing. Just look at their necks. Look how they stand. Look at their posture. When you give a shir, Moshe Rabbeinu, do you find that they're sitting there with bitul das? Do you find that they're listening there, subjecting their own minds to yours while you mold them, while you develop them, while you teach them? Or are they sitting there with their heads thrown back, examining whether or not they agree with what you're saying, deciding whether it fits into their own philosophies or not? Kashu soyref. Those necks are made of iron. They're incapable of bending. They're incapable of being flexible. Moshe Rabbeinu, when you tell them off, what do? Are you talking to the front of their necks or are you talking to the back of their necks? Do they turn around to listen to you or do they carry on walking and refuse to listen to you? You're talking to the back of their necks. Such a people has no hope. And we now begin to see that there is in fact a connection between the kashyus oref, between this stiff-neckedness and the egel itself, the chet, the avera of the golden calf. Because if we understand it in terms of the Kuzri, which we just learnt, then the Avera was not only that they made a form. That's part of it. But the Avera was Sheyichasu Inyan Eloiki El Masha Osu Beyodom Uratsoino. They created an object of worship. They created something to which they attached godly aspects, godly elements. Now I must tell you, one can hardly blame them. Imagine such a situation where the Erev Rav come and they say, now Moshe's gone, I'm sure the Ribbono Shel Olam wants us to replace Moshe. And everybody says, yes, yeah, seems like it, but with who? There's nobody fit. Well, let us think, they said, what is Moshe Rabbeinu's role? He took us out of Mitzrayim and he did this for us and that for us. Yeah, but that's all over. Now what's his role? Well, he's going to take us to Eretz Yisrael. Do we need him to take us to Eretz Yisrael? No. We've got the pillar of fire at night, and we've got the pillar of cloud in the daytime. The Ribbono Shel Olam will tell us where to go. We don't need Moshe for that. What do we need Moshe for? just that representative of that which was perfect, of that which was worth striving for. That when we talked of godliness, when we talked of greatness and of godliness, we could see Moshe Rabbeinu standing in front of us. That's what we needed. We need something material, something visible, something that we can sense standing in front of us, that when we talk about these high concepts, we can see it expressed in reality. And it's true, there's no human being we have who can take the place of Moshe Rabbeinu. We don't have anybody to fulfill. Let us at least make a form out of the most noble of metals. Let us make something beautiful, something perfect, that when we talk of godliness, at least we'll see that and it will remind us of the levels we're meant to aspire to. That's all. They didn't mean to worship it. They didn't mean to sacrifice to it. That wasn't the intention in the beginning, say all the Mefarshim. And eventually people start buying the idea. And even Aaron, it appears to them, is willing to go along with them. And they take the gold and they throw it into a fire, and magic, out comes an eagle. Nobody formed it. It came out by itself. Isn't that convincing? A siman min hashamayim. We can see that the Ribbono Shel Olam is happy with what we're doing. We're on the right track. We wanted to do it, and there's been siyata dishmaya, there's been help from the Ribbono Shel Olam. We didn't know quite how to make it and what to do, and look at it, here it is, miraculously. So the Ribbono Shel Olam is blessing our efforts. And Chazal tell us that that golden calf could talk. Can you imagine the shock then? They establish it up and they put it there, and the golden calf nods its head and says, good yom tov everybody, come, let's rejoice, let's dance. What do you think they thought then? That there wasn't godliness attached to it? Sure they thought it. Can one blame them? So what went wrong? Shiyichasu inyan eloiki el ma she'osu beyodom uratsoinom mibli mitzvaso eloiki. The whole of Torah and the whole of Yiddishkeit is based on starting with God and working from there. To start with our own ideas and work back to the Ribbono Shel Olam, that's avodah zarah. That's idolatrous. They made up their minds. They decided. It was conceived by themselves. It was their chidush. It was their innovation. They made up the idea. They thought it out. And they put it into practice. They executed it. And then they attached God to it. That we can't do. That's not allowed. And that, says the Kuzri, was their avera, their prime avera. And that's something we do very, very often. We decide what we want to do, and we do it, and then we say that God's happy about it. We design projects, we build institutions, and then we say this is what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants. We think of ideas, we think of concepts, and then we say that's what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants. It happens to us in learning, and it happens to us in thinking. That before we've really understood, one's looking at a Rashi, or one looks at a Sipurnu, or at a Ramban, or at a piece of Chumash. And what is one doing? Is one extracting the ideas from the words, or is one imposing one's own ideas onto the words? And the difference is not just in how good the Torah is going to be. The difference is it Torah or is it idolatrous? Is it Torah or is it philosophy? And philosophy has no place in Torah. And it's so easy to do that. To have our preconceived ideas and to look at the words with that in mind, and then to say, and that's what the Torah says. See, look, there it is. So easy. And we dare not do that. When we take something at ourselves, something which we've made beyodeinu with our own hands, uvirtzoneinu, and with our own idea, and we made it, we designed it, we thought of it and conceived it, and then we attach God to it, that's the chet ha'egel that we're not permitted to do. If you want to do it, first find out what God is, and first find out what He wants, and find out what His mitzvahs are, and then build the thing, then do what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants. Don't do what you want and then attach the Ribbono Shel Olam to it. If you have a concept, first find out what the Torah thinks of it. Forget, abandon all your ideas, abandon your concepts. Figure out what the Torah's concept is, and then work from there, build from there. Don't work the other way around. And where does that come from? The conflict between originality and authenticity that we've often spoken about. Where technological education teaches how to be original,
because that's what's important. We don't want people this generation to invent the same things that were invented last generation. We don't want people to discover things which have already been discovered. We want new things. So technologically it's important to forget what's been before and to go further. We don't want authenticity. We want originality. And we've often talked that that is the system of Western education. And that even in the non-technological subjects that are taught in university, today the derech, the emphasis, the attitude is that one, originality rather than authenticity. Rather than to go back to the sources, rather than to understand and appreciate the greatness of the early minds, the stress and the emphasis is the greatness of the minds of our day and what can be done on our day. Nothing should be taken for granted and nothing should be sacrosanct, and don't be afraid to question and to undermine anything that's been said before, because we have to go further in the cause of knowledge and so on and so forth. And that's why we've often said that university is not a place to learn Torah. One goes to university to learn techniques. One goes to the university to learn technology and to learn all the things at which universities are good at teaching. But one dare not learn Torah at university, because Torah and university, Torah and secular education, work in exactly the opposite ends. Western education works on the basis of the Egel Hazav. You create a new concept and then you give it feet. Torah works the different. Find out what the concept is and then we adjust our thinking and our minds to it. What will happen if I think I mentioned last week about a well respected academic who wrote such nonsense in matters of Judaism. So believe it or not, it happened again this week, except this week it wasn't something I read in the papers. This week he sent it to me. He was foolish enough to send it. It was another man, another academic, also very well respected, highly thought of in his field, and he writes an article on the judgment of Shlomo HaMelech over the two women with the baby. And he writes like, if a 10-year-old wrote like that, I would be embarrassed. It's stupid, it's silly, it's unfounded, it's unthought out, it's original, there's a lot of imagination in it, but it's academically, I'm not even talking from a Torah point of view, academically it's such nonsense. And it's already been published in some medico-legal journal. Nobody criticizes it, nobody sees what's wrong with it. What would happen if one called that academic, as I was thinking of doing, and saying, you know, fella, I don't know what you're like in your own field, but if it's anything like you are in my field, you must be pretty bad, because I've never heard such nonsense. What would he do? He would turn his neck. He's not trained to listen to somebody saying, you're wrong. He's only used to somebody saying, you're original, therefore it's good. Why not? It's a nice idea. Let's consider it. The fact that it may lack authenticity, and the fact that authenticity is more important than originality, is something which is so foreign to him, he can't begin to conceive of that. The ability to take toichocha, the ability to take rebuke, is contrary to the desire to be original. The two don't go together. The man who's got to be original can't take rebuke. The man who can take rebuke doesn't have to be original, he would rather be authentic. A man who can be told what you did wasn't right, and he can say, why wasn't it right? Well, I'm sorry, you're right, I didn't realize. That's a man who's interested in getting back to origins and getting to the truth and acting in accordance with the truth. The man who's interested in originality, you'll say to him, you know, what you did wasn't right. And he'll say, in terms of what wasn't it right? Your philosophy? Who says I must agree with your philosophy? No, it's the Torah. Where does it say so in the Torah? Well, it's in the Furush Shulchan Aruch. And maybe the Shulchan Aruch is wrong? He's not able to conceive of what the authenticity is and what it requires. The humility to greater minds, the humility to that which has been before, the humility to the authority of Torah, that's something which is strange to him. And as far as the Ribbono Shel Olam is concerned, that's a precondition for a Torah involvement. A person
that lo yifnu lishma divrei shum moire tzedek. A person is not prepared to bend his neck to listen to a moire tzedek, to listen to a rov, to listen to a teacher, to be guided and to be told and to be mevatel his das. Ein tikvah sheyashuva b'tshuva. There's no way that they can do tshuva, because tshuva means being able to say, I'm sorry. And in Western society, we're taught that love is never having to say, I'm sorry. That's the difference. The two cannot go together. You're never going to say, of course that's what we're taught, you never have to say you're sorry. What are you sorry for? And Torah doesn't work that way. One has to be able to say, I'm sorry. To who? To oneself? To the Ribbono Shel Olam? But how are you ever going to know that you're sorry? Only if there is an authority to whom one is mevatel. There has to be an authority to whom one is mevatel. That's the first step of Torah. Rather have somebody at nursery school level who is mevatel himself to his teacher than people who stood at the foot of Mount Sinai who were not mevatel themselves. Because the kid in the nursery school who is mevatel himself to his teacher will grow and will develop and will learn. And the Jew standing at the foot of Mount Sinai, who's not mevatel himself, will deteriorate and deteriorate and deteriorate. But we discussed 2 weeks ago a strange contradiction, a strange appearance, that, in fact, this ability to be mevatel one's das to one's teachers is the basis and the foundation of original creative thinking. Contrary to what we normally believe. The way we've spoken up till now is the way the world believes. How can you be original if you subject yourself to your teachers? You'll never go beyond. You just accept whatever they tell you. And we learned 2 weeks ago that it's the opposite. That it is only through bitul das that one can develop the capacity for true originality. Because bitul das teaches one to say, even though I've been working on this for years, and even though I've believed it's right, look, my teacher says it's wrong, so finish, let's start again. It enables one, it teaches one to abandon one's earlier concepts. It teaches one to be able to grow away from one's preconceived ideas. A person is unable to do that by himself. A person needs an authority to say to him, this is wrong. And if he can accept that, he's capable of originality. If he can't accept that, he's incapable of originality. But let us examine that very briefly in terms of this parasha. We've now tied up that the originality of the Egel Hazov was caused by their inability to be mevatel. And we've just said a moment ago that the inability to be mevatel should in itself prevent originality, not encourage originality. The Ravera says the Kuzavi was that they made something with their own hands and their own desire, an original religious concept, and they attributed godly attributes to that concept. How original was it really? And here we'll go back to the beginning of that paragraph of the Kuzri. Ha'umois kulom bizman ha'hu, says the Kuzri, all the nations in those days, hoyu oivdim tsurois, used to serve forms. The ilu hayu ha'filosofiim mevi'im mofes ala yichud v'ala elokus. And if the philosophers of those days would have brought undeniable proofs of the unity of the Ribbono Shel Olam, loy hoyu oimdim, they would not have been successful in convincing society, mibli tsuro, unless they would have been accompanying it a form, shemechuvonim eleho, shemechavnim eleho, to which you can point. Vo'emrim lahamoinam, and you can say to the masses, ki hatsuro hazois, that this form, Yidbak boy inyan eloiki. This godly concept is housed in this form. It affects this form. This form contains something of that godliness. Kasher anach loisim ayomim kaimis amichubodim, etc. Veloy hayu maskimim haamoin al Torah achas, and the masses would not have accepted, would not have agreed to one Torah. Elo betzura murgeshes. Without some physical form to which they could point. They needed that. They were not capable, the society of those days was not capable of conceiving of a Ribbono Shel Olam entirely abstract, with no physical representation. They don't need a manifestation. They can understand that God is not physical, he's spiritual. But they need something to relate it to. They need some relationship which can be a sensual relationship and which can be part of their religious life. And Bnei Yisrael were looking forward to that which the Moshe had appointed to them. Sheyorid loim inyan ma'is Hashem, that he was going to bring down some matter, some concept from Hashem. Sheyiru, so that they will be able to see. V'yakbiluhu, and they will be able to stand in front of it. Ka'asher ayu makbilin omud ha'onon v'omud ha'esh b'tzeisam imitzrayim. It sounds primitive, all this, but it's not primitive. Today we've got all these things, so it's not so difficult. We've got shuls, we've got Sifrei Torah, we've got Maran Kodesh, we've got a Kosel HaMa'arovi. Why does everybody go running to the Kosel HaMa'arovi? Okay, there's a bit of Kedusha. You want to tell me that the people who go there are able to feel the Kedusha of the Kosel HaMa'arovi? What a level one has to be on to achieve to feel the level of the Kosel HaMa'arovi. One could take an old wall anywhere, and one could tell everybody this is the Kosel HaMa'arovi, and one could build around it the right kind of atmosphere and have a few old Jews crying and praying there, and we would bring people that would also say, feel the Kedusha. How do you know you're feeling the Kedusha? It can be a very superficial thing. It's not that easy to feel Kedusha in a place where one's thoughts need to be, where one's body needs to be, where one's mind needs to be, where one's neshama needs to be, to actually feel the Kedusha of the Beis HaMikdash in its churban, never mind when it's built, in its churban. What one needs to be to feel it. Yet we go running there. Why? You can stand there, you can see it, you can touch it, it's real. That's what it is. We'd also like that. Imagine how we would feel if we were Jews with no shuls, no sforim, no Sifrei Torah, no Aron Kodesh, no Eretz Yisrael, no Kosel HaMa'arovi, no Sidurim, no Sforim at all, and with a special rule as a God somewhere. How would we relate? It would be very difficult. And so it's not something which is altogether primitive. It might be something which is very inherent. And at that stage they were being introduced into a religion which had yet had nothing. It didn't even have mitzvahs. So what are you supposed to do? Well, there are no mitzvahs yet. The mitzvahs are coming later. How do you express yourself? Do you light candles on Friday night? No candles yet on Friday night. Shechita, there's no shechita yet. What do you do? Well, you don't do anything yet. It's coming. Very difficult. And they were looking forward to the fact that Moshe was going to bring down from the mountain something to which they could see. Something against which they could stand. The way they used to stand opposite the Omud HaAnan, the pillar of cloud, the Omud HaEsh, the pillar of fire, but say some Mitzrayim when they came out of Mitzrayim. And then they heard the Ten Commandments, and they heard it was going to come down in the form of Luchos, in the form of tablets, and there would be an Oren in which these tablets would be kept. They were thrilled. At last there was something that they could relate to in a sensual fashion. V'nish'oru ho'om mitzapim l'redes Moshe. And the people stood and remained looking forward to the coming of Moshe. V'heim al inyonom, and they stood at their same level. Lo'ishonu to'orom, they didn't change their appearance. V'edim u'vigdeyem, and not their clothes. Asher omdu bohem yoy ma'amad ha'sinai, that they stood at the moment of ha'sinai, they stayed on that same level. Ach nish'oru bitchunosom, they remained in their essence. Mamtinim le'moshe, waiting for Moshe. U'voshesh mehem arboim yoyim, and 40 days go past. No Moshe. This Moshe has been promising them. They've given their lives for this Yiddishkeit. They've gone out into a desert, not only with no material possessions, but not even with any material spiritual possessions. No Sefer Torah, nothing, but they're told Moshe's going to go up to the mountain and he'll fetch it. And they wait. 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And he didn't take any food up on that mountain, and they can see there's no mon coming down on the mountain. And when he left them, he specified exactly when he was going to come back, and that time has now gone. Then this bad idea started taking hold on some of the masses. And some of the people started. They started with different ideas and different advice. Until some people came together and suggested that we now have to make something physical. The Luchos haven't come. The Aron Kodesh we don't have. The Mishkan we don't have. The Shulchan, the Menorah, all the things we don't have. Mitzvahs we don't have. A Moshe Rabbeinu we don't have. Nothing do we have. Something physical we need. There isn't a religion in the world that doesn't have something physical. Let's make something that will represent to us the ideas of godliness. Not to abandon the Ribbono Shel Olam, but just to have a mitzvah, to have something physical. And they threw the gold into the fire, and out came this miraculous calf that could speak to them. One understands it. What they did wrong was they made their own mitzvahs. They created their own mitzvah. That's what they did wrong. And how new was the idea? How original was the idea of the golden calf? What did the Kuzari say in the opening of this passage? Ha'umos kulom bizmanahu hayu oivdim letzuros. All the nations of that time used to serve forms. So with all that originality and with all that creativity, what did they come out with? An old, old concept, an old, old idea which has been used for generations and centuries before. That's what happens. It's not possible for the individual, for the human being, to be able to conceive of something new unless he's able to be mevatel the old. Unless he's able to see the old and to say it's nothing, I've got to move away from it. And for that he needs toichocha. For that he needs the ability to subject himself to somebody. Without the ability to subject himself to somebody, there's no possibility at all. The making of new mitzvahs is something which exists in different forms on different levels. Christianity perhaps is the prime example. Comes along in the name of God, makes new mitzvahs. That's Egel Azor. No matter how good the intentions are, no matter how beautiful the ideas are, no matter how miraculous they appear, the Egel Azor also could speak. And probably if you put the Egel Azor on water, it would have walked across the water as well. If it could speak, why not? The miracle doesn't mean that it's true. The miracle doesn't mean that it's good. The creation of new mitzvahs, that is in essence a denial of what the Torah is all about. Reform Judaism, same thing. Changing of the mitzvahs. You can't change. If you change one mitzvah, you're denying the essence. There's no possibility for tshuva. There's no possibility for progress. Not at all. And what happens when you change them? Do you really go further? You go back to the previous ideas. You don't take a step further. Is Christianity ahead of Yiddishkeit? Does Christianity have more than Yiddishkeit? Of course not. It has less. It's a step back. Does Reform Judaism have as much as religious Judaism has? No. It's a step back towards Christianity. You never take a step forward when there's change in this area. We're not talking in the technological area. In religion, in philosophy, in Torah, you don't take a step forward when you make up new ideas, because the human being is incapable of making up new ideas unless he's prepared to be mevatel himself. And for that he needs an authority to whom he's going to be mevatel himself. The Am Yisrael sinned in making a new mitzvah. That didn't bring about their near destruction. What brought it about was their kashyus oiref, was their desire, was their inability to accept toichocha, their inability to listen to the Ribbono Shel Olam, to any authority telling them that what they're doing is incorrect and what they're doing is wrong. The consequence of that inability was that their creation of a new idea, their creation of the Egel Azov, in fact was nothing new at all. It was merely a lapse or relapse back into ancient civilization. It was a step back to primitiveness. That's all it is. And all our new clever ideas are really a step back. When you see a person is learning a Rashi and he works on understanding the words of the Rashi, and he comes and he figures it out, it's beautiful. It's new. It's mind-shattering. And you compliment him, you say, that's the thing. He says, that's not me, it's the Rashi. The words in the Rashi, I didn't do anything. And it's so original. And it's so beautiful. Nobody's ever thought of it. But he's right. The Rashi says it. He's gone back to the authentic roots and he's understood it with a depth and a clarity that he has revealed to others. And when you get the superficial learning, somebody has an idea and he says, look, that's what Rashi says. Apart from the fact that it's very easy to show him that that's not what Rashi says, you can usually show him that his idea is so childish. Is it possible that he's going to conceive of an idea more advanced than Rashi? Is he going to conceive of an idea more advanced than the Rambam, more advanced than the Tosfos, more advanced than the Gemara? It's not possible. So the idea is going to be childish, it's going to be primitive, compared to what's really written over there. But for that we need to be prepared to submit ourselves. For that we need to be prepared to be told, don't be an idiot. Why don't you look what it says? And you'll find a lot more pleasure in it than trying to impose your own ideas on it. What we need to look at next week is, how did it happen? What was it that went wrong? After standing at Har Sinai, how was it that it happened? And I just want to give you an opening to that, so that you can at least spend the subconscious hours of the coming week. I don't suspect that anybody will spend their conscious hours over the coming week, but maybe their subconscious hours of the coming week thinking it out a little bit. Rashi says on the words ki ze Moshe ho'ish, this man Moshe, and ze always indicates that it's something to which you can point, it's something that stands in front of you. Says Rashi, kemin demus Moshe hero lohem asotin, a vision of the appearance of Moshe, the sotin showed them shenoisin oisei ba'avir rekiah shemayim, that they were carrying Moshe off into heaven. So one needs to understand the circumstance very clearly. 40 days have gone past and there's no Moshe Rabbeinu and no news of him. The day on which they understood him to say he was coming back, and he was very precise about that day, has passed and there's no sign of Moshe Rabbeinu. To survive 40 days up there without food, there's no man and there's no Moshe Rabbeinu. And at that moment, they see with nevuah, with prophecy, that's on what level they were, they see a vision of Moshe being removed. Can there be any doubt in their mind that Moshe is dead? Can one blame them for the confusion? Can one blame them for wanting something to which to relate with Moshe gone? And again, we're not dwelling on the fact that they made a calf. That the Ribbono Shel Olam wasn't going to destroy them for that. We're dwelling on the fact that they made something new, that they created an idea. And they created an idea because their source of authenticity was gone. Where were they going to get the Torah from? From Moshe. And there is no Moshe. He's dead. So there's no hope of getting the Torah anymore. Now all they need is something to stand before them to remind them of that for which Moshe stood, so that they shouldn't deteriorate anymore. Their intentions were 100% L'shem Shemayim. Their intentions were sincere and religious and deep. Can one blame them? How were they meant to withstand that vision of Moshe Rabbeinu being carried off? What they saw with all the clarity of prophecy, that Moshe Rabbeinu had in fact died. That's what we'll work at next week. Because it's something that affects every one of us. Sometimes we have ideas and we have principles. And sometimes those principles get shaken up rather badly by events, by other people's principles, by all sorts of things. And comes the question, at what point does one become dogmatic if one sticks to one's principles? And at what point do you stick to them? At what point do you say, well, Moshe's dead, let's do something? And at what point do you say, forget it, we're waiting for Moshe? And they come and they say, don't be stupid, don't be so dogmatic. Be sensible. Is Moshe a human being or not? Yes, he's a human being. Can a human being survive 40 days without food and without water? No, he can't. We've waited for the day that Moshe said he would come back. When did he say he would come back? At midday today, is he back? No, he isn't. So be rational and be an ordinary human being and let's understand the thing properly. At what point is that being dogmatic? And at what point is that being faithful to a principle? That's what we need to understand. And it's Hashem that we'll do next week.